Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Welcome to the Huntivore Podcast, powered by Sportsman's Empire, where we celebrate the hunting and fishing lifestyle through the utilization and consumption of our wild game. No egos.
Fork in hand, beer in the other.
No status.
A piece of red meat on a hot grill and turn it into a burnt offering.
Just catch it, cut it, cook it.
Nothing for him.
Nothing.
But hey, how are you on this fine Monday? Things going well up there in Alaska?
Yeah, it's great. It's beautiful. It's very wintry up here. It just warmed up this morning. It was like 3 degrees above zero. It's been like minus 15 and lots of snow. I'm right on the Kenai. I'll show you. And it's frozen, but I'll just show you what it's like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Dead of winter. It's
I still haven't winter because you're in Michigan, right?
We are. Now you're looking, yeah, back here, we've gotten rid of our snowpack. Mm-hmm. The glare is kind of messing with it, but we've got all of our snow is gone. Spring has tried one or two times. I like to call March mud. So it goes February, mud, April. Yeah. Yeah. It plays this game up and down. We're getting. Mm-hmm. So up in the UP, the Upper Peninsula, they're probably going to be getting feet of snow. They're looking at maybe 1 to 2 feet of snow getting dumped. Mm-hmm. We're looking at maybe 6 inches. Wow. But then at the same time, the lake could totally mess it up and we get 1 to 2 and whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's always a waiting game. You're mm-hmm. just deciding like, well, we can't forecast it. We'll just be ready when it shows up. So
yeah.
Sometimes I like the grip of winter because I know what's coming. More cold, more snow. Yeah. And then, yeah, we get into this season. It's like you just wake up and figure out what it is.
I know you just have to adapt by the day. It's been like that in so many places. Like I live in Santa Fe most of the time. And right now, you know, we're at 7,000 feet. So we typically have winter and we have yeah. ski basin. But this year we only got like 78 inches at the ski basin. And word from friends and family is that it's going to be in the 80s this weekend. And we sometimes...
What a swing.
I know. It's awful. You could be out in a tank top and the fruit trees are blooming and then the next day you have a hard freeze. I mean, you just don't know. So yeah, you just got to roll with it.
Yep. Just got to roll with it. Well, hey, this has been a great little intro. I'm going to do a formal introduction to our listeners that are going to be listening to this. And then, yeah, we're just going to start talking about the book.
Okay.
Well, hey, folks, beautiful afternoon here in Michigan. We're going for a wild ride here. Temps are back down. Shoot, it seemed like we were going to be breaking into spring. Winter has come back for overtime. And yeah, we're about to get a little dusting here and there. Real blustery today. What really is a good day about what to do with today is going to be sitting down and talking with somebody. I just happen to be a podcaster. So this is the greatest thing that you can do when it's really crummy outside, you find someone to have a conversation with. And shoot, we're making a long distance call. We're calling all the way up to Alaska. We're joined by Christy Green, author of her new book, Moonlight Elk. I got to get the subtitle in here. Oh, it's Small Vision, One Women's Hunt for Food and Freedom. Christy, thank you so much for jumping on the podcast. You're currently up in Alaska. For those that are going to be tuning in to the video aspect of this, you've got some amazing furs that are on that balcony. Your vacation home, or is this just a second residence?
No, it's actually one of my dear friends that I grew up with, Michelle. This is the River House, which used to be her stepfather, Norm's house. Norm is a dear friend of mine. I just celebrated his 89th birthday with him yesterday. He's a Alaskan, born and raised in Southeast. And so this was his house for a number of years. And then he's in a house now with just a single story. But the wolverines and the goat, the mountain goat behind me, are from him. And I'm just lucky enough to stay here while I'm working on my second book, which is called Salmon Dreaming, and it comes out next summer. So I get
goodness.
Yeah, I'm just a guest here, and I'm right on the bank of the Kenai. And I'm just fortunate with these dear, dear friends who are close by.
Yes, what a great spot for inspiration to write this book. Well, we'll set that alongside. We'll set that on the back burner because we'll finish up with the second book. But we need to highlight your first book. You were gracious enough to give me a call, said, hey, I really want to talk about my book. And I was like, that sounds so fun. Mm-hmm. I've had a chance to dive into the first part of the book. Mm-hmm. Sorry, listeners, I'm not going to give away anything about this book. I want you to go in and get it. I've enjoyed the audiobook version. In fact, I'm passing it along to my wife. And she's a big audiobook person, commutes. Well, it's like 40 minutes either direction. So she's got 80 minutes where she's just deciding what should I listen to. So that'll be in her log here soon enough. Mm-hmm. But diving into literature that's about what I'm passionate about food, about getting it from the outdoors, acquiring it myself, but then getting it from a really unique perspective. This book really does do a great job at engaging the reader and does a great job at telling a very fantastic story. Christy, this is your story we're talking about. Is this opening up where you first began your hunting journey, or is this come halfway between? Judging by a little bit of the first book, you're going through some learning curves at this point. What first got you into the outdoors? What was your first real spark of inspiration saying, I want to be a part of the wild. I want to then pursue the wild. Where did that really come out early in your years?
That's a good question. I was raised in Alaska from when I was a very young child. And so my reference to the world has always been that the other than human world is greater than we are and more powerful and inspiring. And sort of my way of orienting in the world was always in the other than human. You know, we didn't live like way out in the bush. I was raised in Anchorage, but we had an acre and it was forested and we didn't see, you know, our neighbors, and there were moose coming through the yard. And, you know, we would fish salmon on the Kenai and go pick raspberries and things like that. And also my grandfather, my mother's side of the family, they're a farming family in West Texas. So there was that way of orienting to the outdoors or outside that had to do with food and being in these spaces and places of extremes. And I always had this, before knowing it or being able to articulate it, always kind of had this burning question and quest of wondering, how is it that place shapes people? How do we become who we are based on where we are? And how do we relate to each other and to place? And the way I have always done that is through food. And it wasn't like an intellectual, you know, conscious kind of thing. It's just, you know, when you're raised, you just do that thing where it's the season for fishing or the season for hunting or whatever. And so that has shaped who I've been my whole life, relating to people and place, especially through food. So I would say I didn't have an awareness of a choice, making the choice to gravitate toward what is not human or what is wild, but it was just something I think that was infused in me, like so many people who live in rural places. It's just the way we lived, you know, it's just who I was.
Uh-huh. I love that. I love that. In the fact that too, even different rural spots, there's a lot of things just from your book that I was able to grab onto because I had that pre-knowledge. I've had that rural upbringing, and you would have sentences or phrases that I could really just dive into. I could almost feel exactly what you were going through in that particular moment. Growing up in that rural setting, because now you went, you said you had family all the way over from, you know, starting in Alaska and then heading to the south, near New Mexico is where actually this book takes place. When did we start? You already found yourself in those wild places. When did you find yourself really participating then in the fact of taking your first animal? I guess that's where I'm kind of going for, where then really rubber meets the road. You had seen this, you had observed a lot of this, you lived in these spaces. When was that first dive into really participating?
Oh, well, again, it's sort of interesting because when I was in college, I went to undergrad at UC Berkeley in California, and then every summer I'd go back to Alaska and work. And two of the last summers I worked at a hunting and fishing lodge on the Stony River, and I was there, you know, as camp staff, and I baked and helped in the kitchen and did all kinds of things. But when it came to hunting season, our boss asked us just to step in and do whatever. So I was helping pack out the moose, you know, load them on the pack, put them in the airboat, get them back to camp, do the butchering. We also fleshed the hides and salted them to get them ready for the taxidermist. So I was participating in that way because most of the hunters that came, save for one who was there from Germany, most of the hunters only participated in the hunt and the killing. And then we at camp were the ones that processed them. But I, although my father and my father's side of the family were hunters, I didn't hunt as a woman. It was just sort of something we didn't do. I don't know, it was an unspoken given. And then fast forward to my adult life in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I moved when I was 27, I started working more in cultivating my own heirloom crops and designed gardens for clients. I'm a landscape architect. So my whole niche has always been edible gardens and edible landscapes. And then I met this man, Al, in 2008, and he had been a lifelong hunter. He's from North Dakota. And I thought, well, wait a second. If I'm all about getting my own food and local food and being self-sustainable, why wouldn't I be hunting my own meat? You know, I totally believe in that. And so I asked him if he would take me hunting. And at the time, so then I was, I was 40. I'm 55 now. So I was 40. And I said, would you take me hunting? He said, sure. And so we went up to the Vermejo Ranch in northeastern New Mexico. And that was my first hunt for elk. And that was an antlerless tag. But I took a young bull. He was antlerless, but I thought he was a cow. But anyway, so that was my first dip, which was pretty major. I mean, you know, as a hunter, it wasn't like I had shot squirrels and rabbit, small game, you know, but I didn't have the same frame of mind as I had then when I was 4 years old, being more conscious about, relationship to place through food and relationship to food and wanting something that was more sustainable than, you know, industrial agriculture or, you know, industrially farmed meat. So yeah, it was like a different kind of consciousness at that age, you know, to go do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating that you played that supporting role first in this, the outfitter and then you participated as the full, even though you've got all this new understanding. You knew how to flesh hides, you know how to butcher things, you know how to, what the work was going to be packing it out. Whereas I think a lot of people, though, when they do come into the hunting world, they're shocked and awed by the work that happens after the shot. We're just getting started here, folks.
Right.
I come from the ag background. My family owns a turkey farm, and we raise turkeys. Mm-hmm. We are year round, but yeah, Thanksgiving is the big creme de la creme. So at a young age, I was plucking birds. I was taking birds apart. Like, running a knife was not outside of my realm of understanding, even at like 10, 11 years old. So getting that understanding and then adapting that, I was an adult onset hunter. It sounds very much like where you were like, mm-hmm. I did with my buddies. Hey, take me for a hunt. I want to get into this bow hunting thing. I had gotten my teaching job. So it was, now I don't have college classes. I actually have free time. What is this free time stuff? So I went out with them and they were showing me the ropes, and they were very good on the front end. Just like you said, the killing aspect. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as we brought down that animal, you know, I was ready to field dressed. I knew exactly what needed to have happened, but I hadn't applied it to a four-legged critter. I had done this on turkeys numerous times, but now here I'm doing it on a four-legged animal. Mm-hmm. And so my questions to them were fed with, you know, not very clear answers. And well, now what we know, where do I make my cuts here? Now, how are we going to get this thing out of here? Again, it's met with unclear answers. Mm-hmm. Where do you see that being a big sticking point? Because you mentioned this in the book too, the contrast of the different hunters that you did experience out there, and now living that through the outfitter. We're there to have a good time. We're there to pull the trigger. Mm-hmm. What is that big hurdle? Why is there such a divide between pre-shot, post-shot, mm-hmm. in hunting? Like, you've grasped fully on to that after the shot mentality. Mm-hmm. I want to flush the hide. I want to butcher my own animal. Mm-hmm. I've done all the butchering of my animals, mm-hmm. because I have the know-how, and I'm, frankly, I guess I'm too proud to let it go to somebody else to do the job. But
yeah,
what do you think that big disconnect, why is there so many people that would rather pay you to do it, mm-hmm. than learn it themselves?
Boy, that's a million-dollar question. I think that's a lot of what I'm asking throughout the book, because as I try to share in the book, I had no idea how hunting was going to affect me in the rest of my life. I mean, now, what, 16 years later, I don't even remember who I was before hunting. So it, as the title suggests, you know, one woman's hunt for food and freedom. At first, I thought I was going for food. And what I discovered was this completely different relationship to myself, to my values, to the animals, to land, to what I call home, to how I share food with other people. I mean, it just pretty much deepened and enriched any experience I had ever had of place and people and meals. And then it also showed me so much about my own body and how to value my own body. Like, as a woman in Western culture, how we're seen or valued is so largely superficial. And I will say, I really am appreciating having a conversation with you as a man. And I don't know if most of your listeners are men. A lot of the other podcasts I've done have been with women, which is also great. But the book is not only for women. I think getting at the difference, or some differences, between people who want to have that ongoing connection to and relationship with the animal that they've hunted has to do with, I mean, this is stating the obvious, a different kind of valuing. So I'm valuing the animal, every part of the animal. My house is covered with animal parts. I have quail feet. I have quail tails. I have turkey skulls. I have deer hooves. I mean, I have all the hides, the oryx, the deer, the elk on my piano. I mean, they're everywhere, because they're all they're all stories, and they're all these lives that I remember vividly every moment of that hunt. And they're such a gift. So I don't, I do have, you know, an elk skull and antlers and other antlers and skulls, but I don't consider them trophies. Like, I consider them stories. And I don't know, I'm not trying to say that my way is better. It's better for me, because I have I love every cut. I want to be the one.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Prenuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Prenuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
That's cutting the animal. I keep the hide. I want to do the packing. Like, I was on a deer hunt in Wisconsin. I was with two wonderful men, brothers, dear friends. And they said, oh, I'll carry the deer out for you. And I said, no, that's my labor of love. So for me, it's an expression of love for the animal and for the place. And it's also my way of expressing gratitude. And so when I bring home the elk, you know, and have the hind quarter on the kitchen counter, I'm getting ready to butcher. A lot of times, you know, friends or family want to come over because they want to learn. And they also want to give thanks. You know, it's a way of all of us coming together. It's like communion. And then, of course, sharing the food. So when my experience of the hunters at that lodge in Alaska in the early 90s, and also some hunters now that I encounter, is what I'll call, it's like a form of separateness, like seeing that animal as other. And having the desire for the hunt and the kill, and then maybe, like you say, the finished product on the wall. And maybe sometimes the hunters in Alaska never took the meat home. We would always take it. They only wanted the cape and the antlers, except the one hunter from Germany. But so I just didn't understand it. I don't understand it. And that would take having a conversation with those hunters. And at the time I was 19 and I was the staff. I wasn't going to go ask them, you know, their life story. But it did strike me, the one hunter from Germany, how he shot a caribou and a moose on that hunt. He had come from Europe. It was like this lifelong dream. We ate the brains, the tongue, the heart, the liver. He processed, he scraped the skulls. He did all the processing himself. And he was teary-eyed. He was just swollen with love and gratitude. And the way he showed it was by sharing and honoring the animal in those ways. And so that struck me very deeply. It was always hard for me, even as a kid growing up fishing, to just yank the salmon in and whack the salmon over the head to, you know, quote, dispatch the fish, and then treat the animal as only meat. And meat is sustenance, of course, but they're this genius of a creature, right? How they navigate, what they're able to do with their bodies is beyond. So that's a very long answer to your question with no answer, really. It's just a different way, I guess. Different way.
Yes. No, I appreciate it. And here's the best thing about podcasts is everything's long form. So the more that you explain, the better understanding we get. Mm-hmm. It is amazing too. Like, I mean, I was just talking about some of the parallels between your rural upbringing and my rural upbringing, and how we were unique in our own systems, but yet those values were also very similar. Mm-hmm. When I hear you talk about looking at that animal, I come from a Christian background, and it's funny because even with some of my own brothers in Christ, their view of, there's a hierarchy that we are over the animals. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, it feels weird to have that approach, mm-hmm. knowing that, shoot, right in the beginning, our whole creation was to care for this earth. In the, you know, the story of Eden, mm-hmm. we have Adam and Eve, and their whole job was to be the stewards of that. And so to remove ourselves from that ability to steward the landscape, to be watching wildlife, and to be, you know, in this stage now, trying to find that balance of, we need to have a quota, we need to take these animals to make sure that they can continue to reproduce. I really grab onto that because now I'm engaging in the natural world at this point. I'm creation into creation. And when I take that animal, I really do feel that waste not, want not mentality. You know, partially I got that from my grandfather, and that we don't want anything to go to waste. If you leave a little bit out in that 40-acre woodlot back here, there will be something that will take advantage of whatever you've left. But at the same time, just like you were saying, this is a labor that I'm going to drag this animal out. And if someone were to take me out for food, I'd want them to drag me out. I'd let, if I were to get strung up like this deer, I'd want, I'd want most used out of me. And at that point, go to somebody's table. At that point, our meals are primarily the meat that we do get, whether it's the turkeys from the family farm, but if it's red meat, it's going to be the venison we've taken off our back 40. And that whole idea of being a full participant and being with creation, like that's stuff that vibes with me. And so again, I'm not digging into yours, but like, even if your path isn't necessarily through a religious lens, there were so many parallels that I found in that, that as much as I don't want to point fingers and be like, just like you're saying, they are doing it wrong. They are not respecting what I respect. We don't know their whole story. There's got to be something there. At that same point, though, what are they missing that we are getting? What are, what piece is keeping them from having a full experience with that animal and keeping that animal? What part is injured in them, be it their physical or be it their soul, that is keeping them from basically enjoying the second half of what hunting and fishing is all about?
Oh, I just love so much of what you said. That's just beautiful. It's lyric. Creation is creation. Like, I mean, it's so, in some ways, some things that we say and feel are so obvious, but they're also taken for granted maybe because they're so obvious. But the way you say that is, it just, I feel it so deeply. And like you say, there was a woman at my house recently, and she was marveling at this whole turkey skin. I love to hunt turkeys. That's on my wall in the hallway. And she was touching the gobbler and saying how beautiful he is. And I said, I know, they're just stunning. I can never get enough of watching them. She said, well, that's how, what did she say? God loves his creatures. It's how well he made them. And shows his love through their bodies and their genius. And I had never, it just struck me, I had never thought of that way of relating to love, a spiritual love, a higher being love, as being shown through genius, the genius of design and beauty. But either way, like, yeah, whether there's a religion or a spirituality or a connection, and like you're saying, these different ways, like you're talking about, I love how you're saying, if I were a deer being strung up and being eaten, I would want my whole body to be used. I mean, right there, your baseline viewpoint is empathy. Your baseline is, I'll stretch that and say equality. Like there is an equalness in life form rather than an absolute hierarchy or separateness. And yes, I mean, we do have the means by trigger, by bow, whatever, to be taking these lives. But I hear you speaking. What I hear is relating as kin. It's not like a power over, even though we have that with our tools, right? Or our supposedly conscious mind, supposedly, but or prehensile thumb or whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think that there's, I'm not sure. I think that's part of my aim in the books, both in Moonlight Elk and in this next book, Salmon Dreaming. What I really want, someone asked me this, what's the point of your writing? I'm not trying to tell people what I know or what I think is right. Basically, it's a in the field exploration of questions and what I'm learning. And the one thing I would love is if anybody who reads or listens to the books, if anybody can feel something differently or think slightly differently or consider a different position. Is there a way to relate to the other than human world with more respect and reverence? I think that's what I'm offering. And that's on one hand, pretty basic. On the other hand, it's everything, you know, it's a lifetime worth of what I'm committed to.
One thing I will share direct from the book, your encounter with, it was the cow elk, and you've already raised the firearm, You've already put the bead on the animal. And you have that mantra that you talk. You're like, kill, kill, kill. Like, we're going for this. Mm-hmm. And just before you squeeze your finger to pull that trigger, the calf comes out.
Oh, right.
And when you were talking, this one stuck me. I've had that, not necessarily with a calf. I've had that experience early on with a spike, a whitetail, spike whitetail. But to finish out the thought here, in the book, you give pause to this moment and you end up putting the firearm down. And it was that relation with that mother and that calf that ultimately pulls you from that.
Mm-hmm.
I've had, in the moment, thinking them of as desperate situations where the deer are, they've come through the spot that I'm at. And at this point, I'm using a compound bow. So proximity is everything. And to be gifted deer to come within your range, mm-hmm. Everything's heightened at this point, and you need to make snap decisions. And if they come running in, you have to have that decision ready to go, whether it's, you know, go time, green light, or if it's, nope, just let them go by. They come in a hurry. These whitetails I feel like they almost don't exist, and then they exist inside of 20 yards, like right now. And you got to have yourself put together. I had a spike he was chasing does, and he was pushing them around. And these does just kept their distance, but they kept like circling me. And so I had like three different opportunities, and this was early on in my hunting career. But he was so determined to go after those does, mm-hmm. that he was not looking at his surroundings whatsoever until he happened to catch my eye and look up at me in the tree. And I've got the bow out. I haven't drawn it, but there's this moment where I'm locking with the animal that he's not even as old as he was. He's probably just like less than a year old. He's having an experience with something he's not seen. And I'm having an experience with this proximity with this animal, being as close as I can. I'm supposed to be killing this animal right now, but I'm just overwhelmed that he's come in, and I'm watching all the different aspects that are going on around with him. Then at that point, finally, when I do lock eyes with this animal, you know, I'm at that point, it's gone down from, you know, just like you said, meat, to now I'm just witnessing creation at this point. My arm made my choice for me. I was holding the bow for a long time. So it was like the bow just starts to slink down, but I didn't make an effort to go back for that. And that became more of an experience than a small little experience I had then that I could bring home, talk about. But it is hard to make that, like, you in your head, you've said, I am out here. I'm trying to be cold, calculated. I'm trying to be a predator. And then all of a sudden, our higher consciousness, the one thing that does separate us from these animals. If I didn't have the willingness or the ability to think, and I was on the same level as these critters, I probably wouldn't be a very good hunter. I would definitely be a vegetarian because they're a lot faster than me. They can see a lot better than I can. So the fact that I can think and ambush and have these ability, you know, have the bow with me, that's that one separation piece. But to then find that equality and then shoot, yeah, it is. It's one of those like, well, this is done because now I've got something with that animal. Mm-hmm. So that was that. I really enjoyed that aspect of. I think that was part of the first chapter, mm-hmm. at least in your pursuit of in that that area of New Mexico.
Yeah, that was my first. That's the opening story in Moonlight Elk. It's called New Moon Elk, and that was my first solo hunt for elk. So that's the first time I went by myself. That was in 2018, I think. And, you know, I felt a lot of pressure. And most of my friends who hunt are men, not all, but most. And they're very encouraging. You're like, shoot straight, you know, fist bump, kill, all that. So I'm like, yeah, like you're saying, I'm trying to have that frame of mind, but I'm also, I have a very soft heart. And in that moment when that cow stepped out, yeah, I think I was at like 150 yards. It would have been a clean shot, no wind. She had no idea I was there. And when the calf stepped out behind her, the first thing, like thinking, not thinking, my first feeling was of my daughter, you know, and I thought, and I'm her only parent, my daughter's only parent. And I just, it was, you can't separate, I can't separate the sequence of thoughts. They're simultaneous, almost like what you're saying. It's like all of a sudden, I wasn't sitting there, you know, making a pro and con list. It was like, this is not going to happen. Because there was almost like a synesthesia, like a blending of my experience of the cow, elk, and calf, and my own experience of mothering and my daughter. And it was like, I just put the calf and my daughter, Olivia, as one in that moment. And of course, I wasn't going to take the shot. Now, that also says something about privilege and not being hungry. I mean, if I were a subsistence hunter and I was about to have to, you know, sort of button up for winter and get the larder filled, maybe I would have taken the shot. You know, that was a luxury of day one of a 5-day hunt. I'm not hungry in that way. And then as it turned out, I encountered elk, I think every day that hunt, but I never did take a shot. I went home empty handed, and that was devastating for me. But I made a number of choices. I had other opportunities and then no opportunities. So, you know, we don't know how the hunt's going to go. Oh, we never know. And then some hunts I've day one have taken like the first shot, boom, within seconds. And again, why? Like in our minds, the processing, whatever all the information is, came together with pull the trigger, you know, right now it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you say, it's all within a split second. It's amazing. Nothing's happening. And then everything's happening. And it is life or death within a split second. It's amazing. Yeah. It's a powerful. And when people ask me, I don't know about you, if people ask me, take me hunting or teach me how to hunt, I think, are you kidding? There's no way I'm going to do that. I mean, I'll take my daughter, but there's so much that goes in it because, you know, even taking the shot is part of it. But then like, if you wound the animal, lose the animal, I mean, the conditions getting lost, weather, all of that, there's so much that's involved besides showing up. Like a lot of people, I think you're going to walk a little ways. It's going to be beautiful. And then you're going to all of a sudden have this animal on the ground, which it's very rare that it's that simple. You know, it's a very complex thing I'm very choosy with who I share that with. There's a lot at stake.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the, it's a joking point that we have, but I also think it's a belief that we all have as well as ambush hunters here in Michigan. The distances aren't as great as what they are out west, but the drama and the calamity that can happen between point A and point B to the stand, you can get turned around. It's super thick. I walked into what I thought would be a clear path only to be fully entangled in brambles and having to take off like layers just to get myself out, and then, you know, headlamp to try and finally get my jacket back from all the prickers, to have tree stands, like this is when we had climbers, slip on slippery pine because it wouldn't grab into, and you would just get all these different calamities. And one of our joking points is that if you can get to the stand and get set up according to plan, then you're not going to see any deer. Nothing is going to happen. If you get there, you've already sweated through all your clothes. You're going to get cold in a little bit. You've already lost two pieces of either clothing or equipment, and stuff is just not going right. Something's going to happen. Then be ready, because that's when things come through, is when you're not fully prepared. When you're really, you know, as soon as it doesn't go to plan, that's when things start to look up for you. At least that's our joking point.
For sure.
But to what you were saying as well, that yeah, this is something deeper than just an afternoon activity. I maybe have painted that a little bit with my sons, in the fact that I want them to enjoy experience what dad likes, what we like to do. And we've done small game hunts, and we'd have the baby backpack, and I'd have a kid in, and I'd go shoot some squirrels. And of course, like, they're going, they're like, let me see the squirrel. So you hand the squirrel back to them. And so then they carry the little guys, you know, as we go for our walk. So they've been a part of that. And now we're getting into bringing them along for deer hunting. Mm-hmm. And I want them to make their own choice on when they choose to participate. On the back end, they're like you, they've cut a whole number of venison. They have eaten their fill. In fact, I think that's the only way we're going to get these three boys full through high school. Here, they're still in elementary. It's like 2 pounds for taco night. For burgers, it's two wow. pounds. Like wow. they are eating us out of house and home. So having quote unquote cheap meat or being able to get venison at the just out the back 40 here, that's been a huge blessing for us to do. Mm-hmm. But for them to enjoy coming out with me for an afternoon in a blind, and to have that experience, to have deer come out in front, and to give them the participation that, hey, thumbs up, I take him, thumbs down, I don't. Mm-hmm. I've had one of each. I've had my oldest on a small doe that came through. I looked at him, thumbs up, dad, green light, shoot him. So he got to do that whole thing. He got to be a part of that whole experience. Mm-hmm. My middle boy, we had a deer come in, and I'm kind of glad he did it. It was a little bit further distance, and it was getting a little dark. But he's like, nope, I don't want you to shoot it. Mainly because he wanted to go home. He was like, I'm done. And it was, but it was like, all right, cool. You gave thumbs down. I'm not going back on that. We'll find another time to put meat in the freezer at that point. And ultimately we did, but having the two different experiences and then of them kind of being able to choose your own adventure, choose the outcome of how this is going to be. Are we in it for the full adventure? Mm-hmm. They've done plenty of recovery adventures with me. Or do we want this to be the end of tonight's chapter? So they've chosen both. Mm-hmm. But to your point too, like just taking anybody, hey, would you take me hunting? I'm not sure if we're on the same level, like just like you were saying, like there's a lot more here mm-hmm. than what's on the front page. We don't just pull the trigger mm-hmm. and then, you know, that's run the credits. No, this is just the first chapter of many more to come.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting what you're sharing about your sons. You have three sons?
I got three, yes.
But that you are, I mean, again, this demonstrates a lot, like to actually defer to them and their judgment, because that is you being, I guess, willing, like you say, to let an opportunity go, even if you saw it as a good opportunity and maybe there wouldn't be another one. But also it empowers them so much. Right? Without you saying, here, I'm giving you dot, dot, dot. It's like this way of showing and participating that they actually are capable of reading the situation and having, being able to make a judgment, even if it is like, I'm ready to go home. And then that you, instead of doing this kind of force over, like saying, buck up and we're going to do this no matter what, or going back on what your agreement was, you know, to actually allow for that. I mean, I think that that is huge in instilling a different kind of practice, right, for them as they grow up, if they choose to hunt, you know. It's not like kill, 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 you know, no matter what, this is what we're here for. Otherwise, it's not successful. I mean, that's when I think hunting also gets oversimplified, when this is something that bothers me so much when I get back from hunting. One of the only questions I get asked is, did you get one? And I mean, my God, there are so many other questions that could be asked about what the experience was, every moment of the experience besides that. And some people, you know, not to pick on them, but they don't, of course, they want me to have gotten one for my sake.
Yep.
And so they're eager and they're happy for me and they're supportive, but it's also, haven't had that experience. It's like, if we as a parent were going to try to describe what it's like to be a parent, I mean, we can try to do that, but it's as profound. Hunting is as profound in different ways as parenting. It's very hard to describe. And there is something so deep in the sharing of that practice as fellow hunters that I really long for. And I love sharing stories, and I always want to hear someone else's experience. That's why I love doing these kinds of conversations, because I'm so curious about how other people hunt, you know, matter of practicality or a matter of fact. Plus, I always just love to hear about the animals, but also I always want to know how people are feeling or how, you know, have you changed? Like, how has your hunting practice changed? So yeah, there's so much in it that is so rich. And that's one thing that really is off-putting to me when people categorize hunters as one kind of like kind of a cold-blooded killer. And that's, and we're all one, and we're all angry with guns, and that we have this sort of, I guess I would say like a bloodthirst or something to go out there and dominate. And it is so far from the truth. And that's something I, you know, as you know, explore in Moonlight Elk. Who am I as a hunter beyond even what anybody else's definition or category or words try to describe? It's oversimplified. And if we can't listen to each other on supposed opposite sides or different ways, then where are we except in embedded conflict? And I don't think that's the best way. Anyway, I just went way off on a tangent, but I was inspired by what you were sharing about you and your sons. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I think I've put a lot of thought, and maybe too much thought. I don't know. It's when you sit out in the stand, you got a lot of time to sit and ponder in your own head. Mm-hmm. But that's been something that I want to show them the true picture of what it is, and that, you know what, not every time you're going to come home with something. This is, you know, you look at natural predators as it is, their kill rates are not the greatest. Yeah. That's why a lot of them, you know, you see the best ones out there that are hunting and being successful, but there's a lot of them that they don't make it because they weren't able to bring anything down.
Yeah.
So I've been trying to be purposeful with them to give them something authentic, but at the same time, I want to keep the training wheels on for a little bit, have them enjoy that experience. And then when we take the training wheels off, be like, all right, now we're going to be a full part. You know, I'm still here with you and my hand is on your back, pushing the bike along. A gradual release. It ultimately, I would love it for there to be like an opening day where everybody takes the day off. It's now, this is just a thing that dad and the sons do on October 15th is everybody takes the school day off. Everybody goes to their stands, and it's just then a day of, well, they're in the stands, but then we all come back. We celebrate with each other. We process together. Ultimately, that's the scenario that I've kind of predestined in my head. Mm-hmm. Whether that's going to be through fruition or not, I'm trying to at least give them the fair chance to be like, hey, this is what dad enjoys. Mm-hmm. I would love it for you to just see that. Mm-hmm. Also, jumping on that same idea, when you're having conversations, like when you're saying, did you get something? And then it's, you know, well, yes or no. And then that seems to be where the questions tear off. Mm-hmm. Are you getting that from your friends that don't participate in hunting more, mm-hmm. in the fact that maybe they're a little, mm-hmm. They don't know, or they're a little ignorant to the whole experience of what's going on? Or are you getting that from also fellow hunters that are, again, they're just focused on that? Because I wanted to unpack that a little bit, because like a non-hunter, somebody who doesn't participate, or even someone who's as far-fetched as a vegan, that they're going to have a lot of pre-thought knowledge on who I am. I grew up on a meat farm. I consume meat, mm-hmm. every single day. Whether I fill the stereotype that they've put together in their head or not, it does seem that some of those questions seem to peter off, maybe because of assumption. I'm not sure. Are you getting that from your non-hunting readers and your non-hunting people that you that you're with? Does their line of questioning kind of peter off just out of assumption or not knowing what it's like to go out and acquire your own meat?
I think so. And it's mostly like a innocent kind of inquiry, you know. There isn't the experience, and that's fine. And then most of my, you know, friends and family who do hunt, we can't wait to sit down and hear every detail of the story. Like, okay, what was your rest? How many yards? What was the wind direction? What was the hurt? You know, every little detail, the tracking, all of it, right? So we just spend hours talking about it. And that's the best, because I never get tired of that. And then a lot of times I notice myself I'm trying to not be disappointed in the oversimplification of that question. Did you get one? Because it's like, you know what, Christy, what would I ask somebody about something that they do a lot and are passionate about that I know nothing about? I wouldn't know what to ask, you know? And actually, why can't I shift my perspective and say, well, let me tell you about one thing that happened on the hunt that was great, you know, like when this elk came running at me and she was 4 yards away and then finally saw me and put on the brakes, you know, like this happened, or this one little whiskey jack followed me around for like 3 hours that day, or whatever else. Like, it's up to us, I think, to invite and to open the conversation, and also, you know, to cut each other some slack both ways. You know, like, actually, what if we assume the best? And what if we believe that somewhere within each person there is a curiosity and that there is a wanting to know? You know, people aren't coming at me barking and being negative. I have had some, you know, negative comments, of course, but a lot of that is, you know, they have their own point of view. I was wearing a fur hat the other day in Anchorage, and it's Fur Rondi. It's Fur Rendezvous. It's an annual occurrence there. There are furs everywhere. And this little girl was horrified by my hat. She told me that, and she was scared by it, didn't like it. And I said, you know, I'm sorry, and thanks for telling me. And I don't think I'm right for wearing one, you know. So anyway, going back to the questions people ask, I think mostly, like you're saying, it is people who don't have enough of a reference to know what to ask. But that's okay, because, and that's something I think, I hope, in Moonlight Elk, you know, I'm not just drilling through kill after kill. It's like, look at this landscape that I'm in. Look at the grasses. Look at the, you know, the night sky, you name it. In my encounters with other hunters, it's fascinating to me what people will talk about. I mean, it's just so rich. So there's so much more there than, you know, killing or not killing an animal, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Going through that whole book, the amount of adjective and description of landscape, of animal, of interaction. I mean, you're painting with thousands of brushstrokes, like French Impressionism. Every detail is being placed out there. And when I tell a story from my own experience of my own hunt or something exciting that happens, I get that. I can almost count the number of hairs, or I could tell you, you know, the exact angle in which that animal was standing, or how many of a certain critter came flying in through me. You know, as much as I was spooked by a little cubby of mourning doves that was field edge as I was walking by, you know, for half a second, I couldn't tell you how many that were there, but I could tell you how many were in that little cubby that exploded out, and literally five little birds made this huge explosion and caused me to step alongside, like that little moment of thing. But then to experience that and to see that all happen, only I think somebody participating in the hunt, somebody participating with creation, is going to look at that. Oh, birds flying, like no big deal. Like there's way more to that.
Yeah, I feel that too. I think it is like at least speaking for myself, it's a heightening of the senses and heightened, like a sensuality and sensualness. It's like my grandfather, who was a farmer, like I said, would always joke if I would ask him for advice. I'd say, Papa, what do you think I should do about whatever? And he'd say, Christy, I'm only working from here down. And he'd motion from his neck down. And I think about that now. And I think, you know, he was trying to be funny. He's like, he didn't want to make a decision. He's like leaving it up to me. But actually, if we were operating from here down and our bodies and our senses as our barometer and as our guide, like the animals are, I mean, I wonder how much more connected we might be to creation, to place, to each other, like viscerally, you know, and navigating that way and honoring that more than, or I don't know, more than, or at least as much as reason, you know, logic. I know that's my favorite part of the hunt, is that's when I get to be an animal. Finally, after, it usually takes me at least an hour to cross over. It's that crossing over to the other side, the liminal state of being that is totally tuning into place through my senses. And that is the best gift of the hunt, whether or not I take home an animal, that I actually get to feel I mean, I imagine as close to being them as I can. There's nothing better. it's the gift. I hope I can hunt the rest of my life. You know, I feel like it's the best. It's the closest I get to being my true self.
The amount of money and resources that we put into getting away from ourselves, of people. How can I get away to feel more like a person by literally separating myself from people? It's what an ironic scenario. Mm-hmm. We feel more natural. We feel more like ourselves by getting away.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true. And it's like transformation. I don't know about you, but when I come back, you know, mostly I like to go by myself. And when I come back, it's heartbreaking in a way. There's a very extreme withdrawal I feel when I have to go back to town, and, you know, stoplights and like stores and things just seem ridiculous. It's like, mm-hmm. in all these ways that in some ways, of course, that's our world now. And it's quote progress or contemporary culture, but it's also so far away from like a deeper baseline of connection, you know, and simple basic needs, you know. And I feel like at least for me, the closer I am to having my finger on the pulse of like basic day-to-day rhythms and body rhythms and feelings, then the more I feel balanced and sane and whole. And that comes directly, that's like the direct hit to the vein, you know, through hunting. It's not the killing. It's not that for me, it's not that. It's the hunting that I love.
We have touched on so much of the food for thought. I mean, feasted upon. We've had a great discussion. I'm reining us on in, Christy. Okay. We're coming back inside. We're coming to the kitchen. That's ultimately where it boils down for me again is, you know, we hunt and we pursue these animals, and it's after the shot that the work begins. I asked you this question in the email, and I was hoping you kind of like chewed on it for a little bit. Mm-hmm. What is the meal that you would like a reader to have before they dove into your book? If they were getting ready to start Moonlight Elk, what meal? Now, it can vary on protein. If you don't have necessarily elk in your freezer, like I do, I don't have any elk. But what's that dish that you would like readers to have mm-hmm. before diving into the book?
Gosh, well, when you asked me that then in email and now, I actually didn't think about it very much. It was kind of like going back to how we feel when we're choosing or not. There's not even a choice of pulling the trigger. I had two thoughts simultaneously. And one is, one of my favorite things of opening an animal and taking the muscles and the meat apart, butchering in the field, is the extraction of the tenderloin. I mean, that is a powerful muscle. It's the only muscle that connects the upper and lower body. So pulling the tenderloin out and having that as whole and fresh as possible, that's like a pure expression of the animal, unadulterated, so to speak, doesn't even need seasoning. That hot and fast on the grill, hot, fast to rare, with time to rest, that is like the truest flavor and form for me of elk in particular. Of course, it could be deer or anything else. Mm-hmm. And then the simultaneous thought I had, because Moonlight Elk, that particular elk, which takes place in one of the stories, the last time, it's called In Moonlight Elk. And she's in New Mexico, and most of the hunts in that book are New Mexico. Corn is central to, it's the lifeblood of food and culture and protein and flavor in New Mexico. So one of my favorite things to make with elk is pozole. So blue corn pozole with elk and red chili is, I would say, if you want to have the New Mexico sense of elk or any red meat that you have or meat that you prefer, I would say pozole. But the unadulterated, pure body-to-body would be a tenderloin.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Hey, we're out there. Like, we don't need to coat this with any huge flavor. We're not candy coating here at this point. You played that out in such a raw form in the book. It would only seem logical to have something not messed with. This is raw, or I should say raw. This is the easiest, simplest way to be able to translate that. So I love that parallel too. Mm-hmm. Nothing's wrong with a good old pozole though. Ooh, that sounds wonderful.
I love pozole. Yeah. It's such a good comfort food, right?
Mm-hmm. Now that one, it's not a chili. Pozole is its own thing. Now chilies are incorporated with it. Broth based on that. It's corn in a different form. It's boiled.
Yeah, a lot of people, well, people maybe not in, well, even in New Mexico, but might call it hominy, right? So it's not sweet corn. It's a dry corn, and I like the blue corn in New Mexico. So usually we get the kernels, the blue corn kernels, soak them in water overnight, and then incorporate that. Usually I'll saute the chunks of elk with onion and lots of garlic, put that in with the pozole, then put the broth, you know, elk broth in. And I like epazote and a little bit of oregano, and then like chili pods. So I like chipotle chili pods or any like red chili pods. You could also do green chili, and then let that cook in the crock pot, you know, overnight or for a day or two. And there you have it.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. Yeah. I think you even mentioned that in the book. There's pozole. You came back from one initial hunt and you broke into your pozole that is in a crock pot. Man, what a meal to take on a trip. You know, usually it's like the dry freeze stuff or, you know, yeah, we're doing our short little jaunt. So it's coming home back to regular life really quick. So it's hard to get away and to have some of those really, really authentically deep meals. But no, that the idea of a pozole is so good.
It's so good. You're a good reader, Nick. You pay attention.
Well, thank you. I actually, it was the audio version. I'm taking lectures pretty good. I guess I'm a good listener.
Yeah. Maybe.
I think my wife would probably not go with with that, but I try my best to listen. Very selective listening, I should say.
Yeah. I like to listen to books now too. I find that I sit still less, which is not good. So I listen when I'm cooking or when I'm driving. And I love to hear, I was really glad that I got to read. I got to be the reader for the audiobook because I love to hear the author's voice. You know, when they're reading their own stories, there's just a whole different quality to it, you know, to the stories that way. Yeah, I appreciate that you took the time to take in Moonlight Elk and then to even invite me on the show. And I don't take it for granted being asked to be in conversation. I think it's a gift.
Well, yeah, pleasure's all mine. Thank you so much for being on. Where can my listeners then jump in and engage with you, mm-hmm. and where can they get a hold of your book as well?
A Moonlight Elk is available through the University of New Mexico Press, and anybody can reach out to me at christygreen.net. That's my website. And on the website are links to UNM Press, to buying Moonlight Elk, also to other podcasts. This podcast will be on my website. Simon & Schuster is the distributor. So the audiobook and the book itself are very easily found. I mean, they have it. I've had conversations with people in Australia. So it's everywhere you find your books and audiobooks. It should be easy. And Salmon Dreaming that comes out in 2027 also is through UNM Press. So look for that one too. That's actually part of the trilogy. There's a third book coming. So they all belong. They're a trilogy. So Moonlight Elk was the first.
Oh.
Means the second, and then the third book comes out in 2029. So keep your eyes peeled. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Give us a teaser. So yes, we're gonna be diving into fishing. Give us a teaser of the second book. I know you're writing it right now.
No, it's finished because it's due here in a month. That one is called Salmon Dreaming Coming Home to Alaska. So it compares and contrasts the human way of wayfinding and navigating. Again, like the logical, using maps and compasses and external devices and tools. With my stepfather, Arthur Grants, who was a geologist, he mapped much of Alaska back in the 40s and 50s before it was a state. So it's looking at him and his tools and wayfinding methods compared to the salmon as the iconic wayfinder and how they navigate using only their bodies and water and their senses. And it's my own coming home to Alaska now as an adult. And living here part-time and sort of relearning the Kenai River and this place as a place of connection and identity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. So folks, if you like that little intro to the second book, definitely get yourself on Moonlight Elk first. Start there in the trilogy, and then we'll jump over when it gets launched. Christine, this has been so fun. I'm just gonna have you hold on for a second, and I'm gonna let our listeners on out.
All right, thank you.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed this past hour. Yes, we dug in deep. We got into some rabbit paths, some big circles around talking big picture stuff. But honestly, didn't we already know that? Didn't we already feel that hunting is more than just being good with a bow or with a gun? Is it more than just the high fives that you give people that help you along the way or your buddies that are with you? This is a lifestyle, and that there are twists and turns along it. There are things to enjoy, but at the same time, there's a work that has to be on the backside of this. Are we just cold-blooded killers? I can't just grab onto that. I think we're much more than that. And if you grab on to Christie's book, Moonlight Elk, I think you're going to also resonate with that. I think you're going to come up with your own idea and your own perspective of your own hunting. I think you're going to look at it in a far different light. I think you're going to take Christie's example through this book, and I think it's going to give you time to ponder. So again, as you chew on this metaphorically, I hope you're digging into your freezer as well. Are you going to jump out and try a little bit of pozole? Are you going to make one yourself? Use some hominy? I mean, it'll be hard to get the blue corn, but we can definitely try our best to get the hominy in there. Or are you going to just dive into your next piece of wild game and just keep it as is? A little salt, a little pepper, a little heat, a little char, and take it for what it is and enjoy the simplistic beauty that you've been able to harvest. So whether it's going to be preparing an elaborate meal there or keeping it simple, make sure that the knife you are using is very sharp.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.